Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. It's been quite a quiet time since the World Championship, but the new season about to get going again. And this is a special podcast because I had the chance to sit down with Jason Francis, who's got a new book out detailing his time running the Snooker Legends Tour, and had a chance to talk to Jason about that and also his time with Ronnie O'Sullivan and now the new Seniors Tour that he's starting in association with the WPBSA. The book is called Snooker Legends On The Road And Off The Table With The Game's Greatest. A lot of great stories in there about the likes of Alex Higgins, Jimmy White, Ronnie as well, and Jason's time sort of building up the legends. And it's been a bit of a roller coaster for him, but as I say, he's now looking to press on and run the Seniors Tour and provide some of the older players with opportunities to be competitive again. So this is Jason Francis on the podcast. Hope you enjoy our chat. Okay, well, Jason, thanks for coming on the podcast. And before we get into the legends and the seniors, we'll talk about your early days, because I'm sat here with a snooker champion. You were Cornish under-21 champion.
Yeah, it's funny that people often ask how I got involved in the sport. And I'm a bit like a lot of people, you know. I played as a youngster. I got the bug for it. When I kind of left home to go and do my education, I didn't play for 10, 12 years. Mm. So then the problem is you start to pick up a cue again and you remember why you loved it. But I was never good enough to be a professional. Let's make that very clear. But I came from Cornwall had a real stronghold, especially all the, there was tables everywhere. If you think of the tin mines and things like that, they all had working men's clubs, yeah, and things like that. So it was a rich history. I mean, I started off playing billiards, funnily enough. Right. That's what my granddad played. Yeah. So,
but we're talking 80s, aren't we? So we're talking, yeah, like boom time, snooker's everywhere.
Absolutely. So you're talking, I first got inside a snooker hall in about 81, something like that. And I kind of lived there for 5 years, I guess. Mm. So that was the kind of daily routine. I came from a very small village. It didn't have a pub in the village. Right. So, you know, you didn't, it was kind of the social centre.
Yeah.
And it was always, it always struck me really strange as, like, you know, the village had a men's institute, as it was then, and a women's institute. And we could go in the women's institute, and they always had things like talks on gardening and things like that. But the men's institute was like very much still in the old ages. I mean, there was only one day a year that women could go in there. When they would give out the trophies, they'd allow women to... I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
They'd allow women. But until you got... So you got to 11 or 12, you could then begin to be accompanied by a member. But, they were great times. That was my childhood.
Mm. So, before sort of Snooker Legends and everything, and the two tied together, you were involved in theatre and theatre events. So you became involved in putting things on. And also you sort of strayed into the acting sphere very briefly, I think.
Yeah, so alongside the kind of snooker in my childhood, my mother and father were part of an amateur dramatic group. And so you were kind of dragged along there and then thrown into doing shows and getting on stage. And I guess it was that kind of, it was a family thing. Mm. You never thought anything about it, getting up on stage and learning to dance and sing. And they were good times. And when I finished my O-levels, as they were, and I did my A-levels and I did theatre studies as one of them, and I really enjoyed it. I got a place at a drama school in Guildford, which was one of the top schools at the time. So I kind of left home and, in effect, left the snooker queue at home, went to drama school. It's 3 great years in Guildford, and then probably was a bad actor for 5 or 6 years, trawling around. You know, you dig out old episodes of Casualty or The Bill, you'll find me somewhere.
Okay.
Around there. But it was all the time I found myself, rather than concentrating on furthering myself as an actor, I'd sit there and I'd think, I wonder how that's put on. Mm. Look at the way they're producing that. Who's written this? And I think that was more of an interest for me.
Yeah. You say in the book you describe it very honestly as a bit of a disaster. You did a play about Joe Orton, who was a playwright himself, and that ran in London, and you lost a lot of money.
Lost a fortune. It was it was so tough in those... You left drama school and you got a bit of work, and I got my equity card, which at the time was everything. You know, you couldn't go anywhere without your equity card. Mm. This was before, you know, when reality TV stars could go on television for a week and suddenly be thrown into main roles. You had to, you know, I started off as an ASM, what they call it, running around getting sort of in theatres playing small roles, getting the drinks in, making the props. And it was tough to get in front of casting directors, really tough. And I'd done some research on this playwright, and I thought, God, this guy's a real anarchic character. Those people who don't know much about Joe Orton, the stuff he was kind of doing in the late 60s, you know, was... Nowadays, you know, you kind of, there are no barriers, but you know, this guy was writing plays and, you know, being thrown out of town. Mm. They were being shut down. There was riots going on. He was incredibly anarchic. Mm. And I thought, well, he's got an interesting story. He kept diaries. There was a gap between the last 24 hours of his life when his lover murdered him. So, and I thought,
got everything.
There's a bit of a story here. So I put the play on really to try and showcase myself as an actor. Mm. Truthfully, I enjoyed writing it more. I enjoyed building the set. And I say, really, not many people came to see it, and I picked up the bill.
Mm. Well, it can happen. But I think what comes through this book, reading it, is persistence. Because, you know, there's been a lot of times where you could have just sort of packed in, but you've kept going, and that brings us nicely to the snooker legends. Where did you get the idea from it? Obviously, you've grown up playing snooker, but then you kind of, as you say, put your cue down, got into other things. When did you sort of get back into it?
I created a theatre company in '97 with a mate that I'd been performing with, and it was basically children's theatre shows. And for 10 years, it was incredibly successful. Mm. So we would get the rights to things like Bob the Builder, Thomas the Tank Engine. We'd write the show and we'd produce it under license and tour it. And so therefore it built up my connection with all the theatres. Obviously I learned how to produce a show, how to put on an event. Come 2009, 2010, we were getting a big drop off in audiences. And what was happening is that, you know, the revolution of the internet and phones and things was coming in.
Yeah.
And whereas before you would get 9, 10, sometimes 11-year-olds coming along to the theatre, suddenly, you know, you get above 6 or 7 and they weren't interested. Mm. So we saw a decrease in market, and we sat down and said, well, look, we have to be careful here because there's a decline coming. What else do we know between us, using the experience we've got, that we can put on? And I thought, well, I know the sport of snooker, and there's no, in effect, seniors tour or any vehicle for these guys who were household names. And I also thought, I loved the game show Bullseye when I was young. That was Sunday nights for us.
Yeah.
And I thought that could be a vehicle as an entertainment show. So we said, well, okay. And I wrote them and I kind of devised them, and I went and sat in front of... Well, I manufactured a situation to be in front of Jimmy White. Right. It's the truth.
Yeah.
I'd got back involved a little bit in snooker, and I proposed to the league that I was playing in, why don't you have Jimmy White for an exhibition, which is something they'd never done. And my idea was that I wanted to sit there and say to Jimmy White, look, I'd like to create this thing called Snooker Legends, and I'd like to take you and Alex Higgins back to the Crucible Theatre. And, you know, as Jimmy famously said, they kind of laughed at me. Mm. You know, they thought that, well, you know, you can't have snooker at the Crucible. It's, you know, only the World Championships at the Crucible. And I don't think 2010, and then I don't think Jimmy had been for a few years. And obviously it had been a lot of years since Alex had played there. Mm. So then I kind of produced the contract. And I said, well, actually, you know, I've looked into this a bit. And yes, I can't put on competitive snooker with prize money, but we can put on an exhibition with appearance fees without sort of contradicting. Mm. So I kind of sold on the idea. We put like 17 shows in. Jimmy went off to the jungle, which was fantastic for the profile at the time. It was that year.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, within like 48 hours, the Crucible sold out.
Mm.
And it was, I mean, it shocked me. I mean, I thought it could work. Mm. Meanwhile, Bullseye couldn't sell a ticket for love nor money.
Yeah. But I guess, I mean, Jimmy, obviously, as you say, massively popular, but also important to get him if you're going to get Alex, because Alex, and I mean, Alex fell out with everybody, but he loved Jimmy and would do anything for Jimmy.
Yes, I mean, I obviously Jimmy was the key to securing Alex. Jimmy also knew that Alex sold tickets.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Jimmy... Jimmy wasn't surprised it had sold out, and I think by Jimmy's own admission, Jimmy would understand that probably the reason why that first season was selling so well was because here was a chance to see Alex Higgins play again in iconic venues, surrounded by other legends, with a kind of VIP element to it, which is something we took from our from my theatre company. Never been done before. I mean, nowadays you can go to the World Championship and you can you know, get a hospitality lunch, and those things are available. Back in 2010, we kind of started that. We gave access to the players, we did VIP receptions, we did, you know, we merchandised, we, you know, so I think we were the kind of first people to do that. And of course that was right up Jimmy Street. I mean, much easier to turn up and be loved and pot a few balls under no pressure and get paid for it than scrapping it out in the qualifiers.
There's an incredible chapter about Alex, that detailing that whole night at the Crucible and kind of his behaviour. And it kind of, reading it, it just sort of felt like I was almost reading the story of his life. You know, he kind of, everyone loves him, everyone wants to see him, but then there's a row, there's an argument, and he ended up sort of stomping back to his room, and there was sort of a note on the door, and you probably can't repeat what was on it now, but it was a bit of aggro, basically.
There was, whenever, and I was, I'm not really qualified to talk too much about Alex. He was in my life for 6 months. I mean, he was in my life pretty daily for 6 months, but there was an aura.
Yeah.
There was a feeling that if Alex was in the room, even if you couldn't see him, at any moment, something could kick off. Now, I'm not sure that most of the time anything did kick off, but there was always this kind of, and I'm also not sure that he didn't enjoy creating that atmosphere. You know, he certainly was very clever, and he knew, he was very aware of the situation. He was very aware of, put a snooker cue in Alex's hand and putting him in an environment around a snooker table, he could still command respect, whereas probably he'd lost that outside. So yeah, it was a pretty emotional time. And you know, I say that, you know, I took a lot of criticism for Alex playing that night in Sheffield. Anyone who knew Alex pretty much would have told you that I had no say in it. If Alex Higgins wanted to turn up and play in the Crucible and discharge him from hospital, I wasn't going to be able to stop him. You can imagine, you know, he thought there was a row then. The row, if I'd have said, Alex, you're not playing. And of course, we had a sellout audience out there who wanted to, I mean, in their minds, it's how relevant it is. They wanted to say one final goodbye, and it really was one final goodbye to Alex. So yeah, it was an emotional time, and it was a pretty stressful time. I remember kind of wondering whether I had an unbelievable thing here I'd created, or whether this was going to all badly end in tears.
And you started to build a tour, but what you did was you started to get maybe some more reliable legends on board, the likes of Dennis Taylor, Cliff Thorburn, these people who for years have been steeped in exhibitions and sort of ultimate professionals, but also still massive names.
Yeah, and you know, I think I say that without Alex Higgins, snooker legends wouldn't have been created. There is no doubt. But the fact that he got kind of replaced after one show has allowed it to grow into what it's become now. Because I think realistically, at some point across 17 shows in that first season, no matter, you can put the term exhibition on it, these guys, you put Higgins and Thorburn across a snooker table, you're going to get probably them trying even harder against each other than they would have done in 1980. And the same thing with, even now, you put Jimmy and Stephen, it might be all very nice and VIPs and handshakes and stuff. The moment the game is on, they are trying as hard as ever to beat each other.
And what was it like kind of working with them? Because obviously you've grown up, they're kind of your idols in a way, as a big snooker fan. Now you're working with them, but you're having to be professional. You can't kind of be a fan too much, can you?
No, absolutely. And I think that was because, as well as kind of doing the theatre shows, I was directing some pantomimes at the time, which had some fairly big names in it. You know, I'd been used to being able to work with egos, and I knew how important it was kind of not to have one of your own. I mean, over the kind of the whole year since 2010, you probably can count on one hand the amount of times I've probably sat down and talked about it personally. I've not tended to be one that rushes in front of a camera and tries to self-promote. I get my kicks out of seeing other people's enjoyment, and also being able to, in effect, you know, you can list the players. Some of these guys never thought they'd get to go back and play in the Crucible again. They thought that had passed them by. So yeah, it was very. I never intended to tour with it, and there was a. You know, my personal life probably struggled because I was away so much. But it was after that first show that I realised that I did have to be there. Because in effect, my team were children's theatre company teams. They didn't know snooker, they didn't know the sport. So I was the conduit, really, between the event and the players. So I think that what I did, I had unbelievable support from day one. You know, there was no doubt that they could all see value in what I was creating, but I'd like to think that we always treated them fairly, and because without them, I had no product, I had no show. It's not like you can, like in a play, you can put an understudy on.
Sure, yeah.
You know, they are the name selling the tickets.
Yeah. And I think one important decision you made as well was to get John Virgo involved, because he sort of compared a lot of these, and he's like, obviously he's been on Big Break, he's been in the media as much as he's been known as a player, and he's an important component of it as well.
Massive. And John will say himself, he was very reluctant to try the live commentary to start with. I felt that we had to set ourselves up as being something a bit different. You weren't going to see snooker of the standard of O'Sullivan, Selby's, Robertson's at those time. So what we were going to provide, we were going to provide entertainment. Now, with all due respect to Jimmy and Stephen, they're not going to stop a break to tell a gag and entertain the audience. You put Dennis out there, you put a microphone on him, then you've got years and years of craft, I call it. They know how to work a crowd. So what JV was able to provide is not only an unrivaled knowledge of the game, because no one could say he didn't know what he was talking about, but also he had that theatre background himself, and John and I have sat down so many times and talked about our pantomime days, because obviously he did it for a number of years, and he gets it. He gets live theatre, and John can express himself. He knows when to tell a gag, he knows when to keep quiet, and he does. He provides that the link between the play and the audience, and we have him doing his trick shots, and sometimes we'll get people out of the audience. So we want people. We knew it had to be something a bit different, and I think more than anyone, JV is the person that has provided that.
I think it's worth sort of looking at how much planning goes into these things, because it's true as well with the Pro Tour. I think a lot of people, including a lot of players, don't kind of understand, you know, they turn up, it's all the tables are there, everything's there. They don't understand that there's been months where people have been working to get it all to happen. So how much sort of work goes in, even to one evening?
Oh, massive. And again, you know, generally you will book a theatre 6 months out. You will have all the marketing, PR, even nowadays, I mean, it's harder to sell tickets now than it ever was. There is no doubt that people have so much choice of what to do with their money. There is so much snooker about. You know, it's not a case that when we first started before Barry, six tournaments a year. So in theory, there's a lot of people that would probably follow the tour round because they could only see an O'Sullivan six times a year. Now, if you want to, 30 tournaments, there's so much snooker that there's plenty of reason not to get up and actually go to a theatre, because you can, you know, you've got it on your TV, you've got it on your phone, your iPad, you can have it and whenever you want, on demand. So there's a lot of planning, and also we had to be very, from my background, and you will understand this as well, dark time in theatres costs money. So therefore, I had to develop a model that basically was a one-day stand, because I couldn't afford to have days when there was no money coming through the door in theatres, because they're still going to charge you for their crews, their time, everything. So we had to design the show that it could arrive in the morning and play that evening. Now we've gone one step further. We can arrive early in the morning and play by 1 o'clock. But to the key is, for those people walking in, as I say, they'd probably be shocked at how the place had looked only a few hours before. So I know it's something that has helped us be very viable, and it's something that I think by Jason Ferguson recently said, he said, you kind of opened our eyes up to about it, that you know, you can be a nimble model. if you think, nah, I'm not carting 11 tables round. So, you know, it's a very different model.
Yeah.
But you are exactly right. I can only imagine what a table fitter thinks when he's probably worked through the night setting up 12 tables to have a top professional go on social media and slander his work. Because, you know, they've never missed a ball, and it's all, the table's always rolled off. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, and it must be very disheartening.
Yeah. Okay, well, so you work with Alex Higgins, who is a firebrand. You work with Jimmy White, who, you know, everyone loves Jimmy, but he's not always necessarily the most reliable. So you thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get an easy life. I'll work with Ronnie O'Sullivan. So how did that start? I mean, it makes sense, obviously, commercially, to get Ronnie involved, but how did that kind of happen?
So that came about because, and again, you know, I have to thank Jimmy. You know, we sadly we lost Alex, and there is no doubt we, in effect, it's like any pop band losing its lead singer. The top of the bill had gone, in effect. Jimmy invited me along to a charity night he was doing with Ronnie in Colchester, and he said, I've told Ronnie about you. Ronnie hates exhibitions. That was what he actually said to me. He said, but I think the way you're doing them, the way it's kind of set up and we're protected, I think that Ronnie would be interested. So of course I went along thinking, I'm going to leave tonight with a booking with Ronnie O'Sullivan. Ronnie O'Sullivan is going to join Snooker Legends. So I turned up, and he quite clearly had not a great deal of interest in being there. He was raising money for a good family friend, which was a very, you know, a very noble cause. I think he'd have happily paid double what they were going to raise not to have to actually be there. But what happened was his son was there, and little Ronnie was very young. And so the moment they found out I did Thomas the Tank Engine, which was little Ronnie's favourite TV show at the time, suddenly that was the kind of, I mean, it was just a stroke of luck. Ronnie went, little Ronnie loves that, I've got to come and see your show. So we arranged for him to, you know, I was thinking, come and see the show, I'll put it in your front garden if you want. So Ronnie came along to Dartford with little Ronnie, saw the scale of the production, which was, you know, Thomas was probably the biggest production we did. We were a massive theatre in Dartford. We'd sold out 3 or 4 days. And I think he saw that from a production point of view, I knew what I was doing. So he went, he said, look, we'll try a couple of shows. So I think 2011, we planned to do one in Blackburn the day after the shootout had been in Blackpool. So that was our first one. And, you know, we'd very much got used to our format where we start at 7, the interval comes at about 8:45. They play the final after 9:10. We're done probably 9:45. Autographs, 10:30, 3.5 hours, good night out. Jimmy and Ronnie turned up. 6 centuries in 9 frames. I'm looking at my watch, it's 8:40 and we're done. And I'm thinking, goodness me. But, you know, it was what it was. Everyone had had an unbelievable night. But for me, from a kind of wanting to provide value for money, I thought, I'm going to have to make these matches a bit longer with these two involved. So that's how it started.
And you ended up spending a lot of time with Ronnie, because he started to want to do exhibitions. He did a lot, and you spent a lot of time with him. And what comes out, I think, like I mentioned, Alex and Jimmy, who I think they're authentic wild men of the sport. They've lived a life. I think Ronnie often gets bracketed with them, but you kind of make the point, he's not like out every night drinking at all. You actually say he's quite a boring bloke in some ways.
Absolutely. And this is the biggest kind of misconception about Ronnie O'Sullivan. I mean, I'm very lucky he's become, you know, one of my best friends over the years. We've had some unbelievable times together. And for me, those unbelievable times haven't been when I've been at his side winning Worlds, Masters or UKs. That will be the quiet times. And it might be, you know, a quiet meal somewhere, having a laugh on a motorway. You know what it's like with exhibitions and stuff. It's you put a performance on, and then it's kind of like there's a bit of a downtime as soon as you finish your performance, and you might have 2 or 3 hours in the car. And you know, those times are probably the most times I miss from not being with him day to day now, because you know, we'd have to take it in turns to put on the music and abuse each other's music choices. We'd get the big munchies, which for him, you know what he's like, you know, with his eating. And then I'd be ruining him with donuts in the car and God knows what else. So they're the brilliant times. And you know, and as I say, our friendship has survived kind of 6 years of almost day to day, and it was basically management. Let's not, you know, we can dress up as one. I was kind of looking after sort of everything on his day to day at the events. Sometimes managing quite a tough relationship with the governing body. Obviously he is their prize asset, their most commercially valuable player, and at the same time he has obligations to the sport. So sometimes you kind of, I felt my job was, I called it kind of filtering the chaos. You know, there was needed to obviously make sure that he was well prepared enough to do the very best he could, but also at the same time try and make sure that his employers, so to speak, were also getting as much value as they could in a way that, because everyone wanted to see him win. You know, the World Snooker were not going to go out of their way to do anything that would not give Ronnie O'Sullivan the best chance of winning any tournament he's in, because whether people like it or not, at this moment in time and for quite a while, he will drive the highest ratings, he'll drive the biggest interest, and he will bring people into watching snooker who probably are not snooker fans. So it was they were great times, but you know, I had to be very, very wary of when I look back, what do I kind of want to look back on? The fact that I carried Ronnie's cues around for five or six years, or the fact that I kind of tried to make my own mark and build my own thing, and eventually, hopefully, you know, leave behind this legacy of the World Seniors Tour. So, you know, we still do our shows together, we still speak all the time, and it's, but, and as I say, without him by my side for a vast majority of last season, he won five tournaments, so maybe I should have stopped him years earlier.
But the point is, I guess, in terms of the legends, he obviously, getting him on board did help drive audiences, and you also started to, they weren't just exhibitions, you had like Legends Cup and started to, I mean, you had an event on Eurosport and things were starting to kind of take off, really.
Yeah, I mean, the key was always, for me, it was, we had to keep evolving. So whereas, and again, that was from a theatre, just the same as, you know, I look back to, you know, a pantomime, which comes to a theatre every year, it never brings the same cast every year. There has to be a reason for people to come again. So we would introduce different players, different formats. I love the idea of creating a Ryder Cup, which we did first, and it's been unbelievably sort of successful, and now kind of World Snooker have it again. And I used to love the Nations Cup back in the old days. And I think that's something that you don't get a lot in what is primarily an individual sport. And when you see these guys come together and play as a team, I actually think that they enjoy sharing the workload. So Legends Cup was great, and obviously the breakthrough onto Eurosport was probably the one time that I thought, okay, well now we're kind of, this is it, we're going to be televised, we're going to be doing our own stuff. And it probably, it was a bit of a reality check when that didn't happen. You know, we'd done the viewing figures, we had an unbelievable lineup, but you know, realistically, I understood, if I stood back from it, that we were probably going to be in danger of becoming an alternative for some of the major broadcasters to what World Snooker were doing. I understood that.
Well, that brings us on neatly onto your sort of relationship with World Snooker, and in particular with Barry Hearn, who came along in sort of 2010 to be World Snooker chairman. And you tell a story about you sort of go to meet him, and he kind of, he plays you a little bit, doesn't he? He kind of, he was sort of having a go at someone, and he left the door open so you could hear it, so already you're kind of on tenterhooks.
Oh yeah, no, he dumbed me up like a kipper. he really did. I mean, it's kind of like, I have an unbelievable respect for Barry. And, you know, trust me, there are rhinoceroses in the world that wish they had skin as thick as Barry. What he's taught me a lot of things without actually telling me. You know, I now understand that no matter what you do, you can't please everyone. And I'm a pretty sensitive person. So I wasn't very good in the early days at responding to criticism or feeling hurt. Because, you know, I understand that you can't please everyone. You've got to just, it's the same with promoting, and we're on a very, very different level, but we're both promoters who put our hand in our pocket to risk our own money. And we're there's a rare breed of people that have the kind of belief, I guess, to do that. Because trust me, we don't get it right all the time. And you know, Barry will honestly sit down as well and say there'll be plenty of times when he's put on events and lost money. There's plenty of times I've put on events and lost money. And the key is that it's the same event. So putting on an event that makes you lots of money doesn't suddenly make you a better person than you were than when you put on the event that lost money.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the key has been to never try and feel one way about it, either way. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, you know.
But it seems now you've got a good relationship, certainly with the WPBSA, and you sort of started the World Seniors or revived it, but now you're going to be working with them effectively on a tour. So tell us about how that kind of started.
Yeah, I think it had, I think I was becoming a problem. and I think that's the truth. You know, I was kind of, whereas World Snooker don't necessarily have any responsibility to the former players, in respect the WPBSA kind of does. You know, they're the reason that people now can go out and win professional tournaments, which is in effect life-changing money, is in some part due to what these guys did in the 80s and 90s. They all played their part in it and all got paid well for doing it, so you know, I don't underestimate that. But I think that I come to a point where there's a lot of former professionals out there who fell off tour and have had nothing to go to. They probably started playing snooker as soon as they left school. A lot of them didn't have a big education behind them or a trade, and so therefore there's very little work, coaching or exhibition now. It's certainly not enough to sustain a full-time job, and it's littered with hard luck stories of, you know, former professionals who fell off tour, and what do they do? What do they do? And I think that, you know, potentially what we're starting now could lead on to something where suddenly there is an alternative. It's going to take a few years to get there. You know, I understand that, you know, the World Snooker Tour can offer them £15 million in prize money next season. We've got 200 grand. But it's 200 grand that wasn't there before. And there will come a time when the players who are over 40 on tour, who perhaps are struggling to make ends meet, might just look at the World Seniors Tour as a viable alternative and think, well, where am I better placed trying to earn some money? Because if we start getting, and it will happen, we've got £25,000 for our world champion this year, we start getting into the 30s, 40s, £50,000, then realistically, how many of those players who are lower ranked are earning that in a season? And do you really want to be playing Mark Selby first round? Do you really want to come up against, you know, so our job, and this is where the WPBSA have been fantastic, and you know, Jason gets it, Sean Murphy, who's come on the board, gets it. He understands that this should be their kind of pension if they choose to play on it. There's no, you know, some players might finish their professional career, and if they've done well enough, they might never want to see a snooker table again. But what I've seen from the amateurs coming back is that they've all got their hunger back.
Well, I think it kind of, if you've been playing snooker, as most of these guys would have been since they were kids, you know, maybe 8, 9, 10 years of age, it's in your blood. It doesn't leave you. They may have drifted off the tour, had to get other jobs, but they probably would still have been playing in leagues or whatever. It never kind of leaves you, does it? And now suddenly they have a chance to be competitive again.
Yeah, and also a time to kind of see each other again. Sure. I mean, it was amazing the first season. We turned up at a club, and I think it might have even been Barry Pinch, turned up with a lot of old pro-am draw sheets from the days. And they were all gathered around. Some of these people hadn't seen each other for 20, 30... I know Stefan Mazrosis, who played on our tour last year, he turned up at an event at which Jason Pegram was there. Who was wearing. They hadn't seen each other for 30 years. And Stefan used to live in his house.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, these guys are rekindling sort of friendships. We're a bit corny about it. We kind of say, look, you're renewing your old rivalries and making new memories. But that's what's been lovely to see, the camaraderie, because they were all in the trenches together in Blackpool.
Yes.
Yeah. Most of them never made it, but they never lost their love for the sport. And it's almost like, I say, it's dramatic to say people who've actually, you know, been away at war together, and there's that camaraderie and brotherhood. But it kind of feels like that from the outside sometimes. You see people, it's just being in the slipstream, talking about the old times, you know, and they can all remember every result. They can all remember every time they played each other. And that's been a huge part of this as well. And the WPBSA have made a big commitment, and so for me it's only fair that I meet that commitment, which is probably why, you know, for the past 12-18 months, Snooker Legends has very much kind of taken a bit of a back seat.
Yeah.
Because this needs all my energy if it's going to get to where I think it can get.
So in the initial sort of next year, how many events are there going to be?
So we've got 6 ranking events this season, and we've got 15 qualifying events. So that gives anyone over 40 a chance to kind of win a match at the Crucible or whatever. And then of course our UK champion and our world champion get to go to Sheffield to play in the World Professional, which again is an unbelievable opportunity that part of being in the WPBSA family has given us. We would look to grow that. I'd like to see, you know, 50,000 for our world champion within 2 or 3 seasons. I think it's doable. I think what we have to be careful of, and what I have a certain responsibility for, is we don't go too big too quickly and then have to shrink. It should be a natural progression where we can improve each year. And it might be easier to throw all your eggs in one basket and make a huge headline about a big prize for a tournament. But if next season you come back and saying, it's probably only going to be half that this year, we don't want to go in that direction. So it's kind of, it's steady growth, and it's we must also plan for a time where we can't rely on the likes of Dennis Taylor and Cliff Thorburn and that element to it. The World Seniors Tour will have to stand on its own 2 feet with its own ranking list, and we'll have to kind of sell tickets based on the players that are coming through.
Yeah, you got Stephen Hendry involved, and that's no small thing, because he had put his cue down. I mean, he retired very famously, but you sort of enticed him back, or I mean, how did that kind of work? Because I got the feeling he would just not play again.
I think he'd reached a point where he'd gone to China to play the Black Eight, which I think in 2012 was probably still quite a new game, and so obviously he was able to go to China, and he was, you know, just reached the last 8 of the World Championship, I think. So he was fairly sharp and could compete in what's a very different game, heavy balls. But what quickly happened, I think, as the game grew, is that these Chinese kids became pretty good at this game.
Yeah.
Stephen was only going out 6 or 7 times a year to play them. And I think just as snooker, what was frustrating for Stephen was that he fell into more of an ambassadorial role for the sport as the most decorated player, but he wasn't able to compete in that sport. And the one thing Stephen Hendry hates more than ever is not feeling he can compete.
Yeah.
So I think that it was clear that if we could come up with the right vehicle, Stephen was going to consider playing. The last year, he'd already had commitments in, so on at least 2 of the tournaments, he came back the day before from China. He didn't have time to prepare. And he didn't just come back the day before from China. He'd spent a week bashing 9 balls around for, you know, not good preparation to come back to the snooker. This year, by his own admission, he says, you know, it feels a bit more serious, a bit more... and there probably isn't the expectation. Last year it was like, oh, Stephen Hendry's only got to turn up and he's going to win.
Sure, yeah.
Now we're past that now, because people have seen the quality of the amateur players. I've seen that we've got Jimmy and Ken playing in them. So in some respects, I think this might actually be better for Stephen this year, because it won't all be about him, and people will kind of understand that he can't just turn up and expect to win.
Everyone listening to this, they'll be snooker fans, will know the name Stephen Hendry. Wouldn't necessarily know the name Aaron Canavan, but he won the World Seniors Championship.
Yes.
What a moment for him. I mean, incredible. The sort of thing I guess he just never thought could have happened, really.
It was, if I could have sat down and I said, right, I've got 4 events next season, and who can win? You know, Jimmy White winning again in front of his son was unbelievable. Steve Davis stepping in for Stephen Hendry in Goffs and getting the trophy from Alex's daughter was unbelievable. Cliff Thorburn at 70 years old winning in the Crucible. But the biggest story of all, and it justified this whole concept, was 42-year-old Carr Valiter from Jersey, never been a professional, played club snooker, put the hours in, entered a tournament, won it, went to Scunthorpe and had a black ball respot for the World Seniors Championship and £10,000. I mean, it's I couldn't have written that script. You know, no one could. And he is part of Q Sports history now. which is bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it kind of shows that, you know, because this book has quite a few highs and lows, it's a bit of a roller coaster, but I think it shows that you feel you're right to have stuck with it. There are times where you could have maybe just knocked it on the head, done something else, gone back to the theatre or whatever, but you stuck with it, and now you seem very satisfied with kind of where you are.
Yeah, I think I feel justified in that we stuck at it. I take nothing for granted. It's still very hard, and I said in some respects, partnering with the WPBSA, I feel a greater responsibility. I feel very indebted to the guys that were there at the start, and I think that they've shown me incredible loyalty, and I think that over the next few years things will have to evolve and change. This can't be about Jason Francis. You know, the World Seniors Tour needs to kind of operate on its own two feet, and it shouldn't just be about one person. And I have to make sure that the right people are in place, so that before this needs to go on well past when I'm finished in snooker, and the things we're doing now and over the next few seasons, not instantly, should put things in place for that. We're looking at some, you know, great projects outside of the ranking events, some things we can do with the legends. You know, we've got a lovely idea to, you know, we're going to bring Pot Black back, and it's going to happen. We're going to do it. We've got the old trophy, we've got the legends, we're going to, it's just a matter of time to find the right place to do it. But we will look to use these legends to go to other territories to help grow the sport. And again, we've got a responsibility to do that, and this is where these guys can be fantastic. They can inspire a generation. A young child may come to one of our events in a foreign country that doesn't have a ranking event, meet Stephen Hendry or Jimmy White, take up snooker, and who knows? So that I guess is the long-term plan.
Okay, well, the book is called Snooker Legends: On the Road and Off the Table with the Game's Greatest, by Jason Francis. Jason, thanks for being on the podcast. It's been great to talk to you.
Really appreciate it.
Cheers.